The program is primarily for those newly diagnosed and their primary personal caregivers, and it's specifically designed for the roughly 2 to 6 week period between diagnosis and the start of treatment. The time when we have, as survivors, a minimal amount of information, but a maximum amount of stress. It's designed for basically anyone in treatment, especially the early phases of treatment. And the purpose of the program is to answer the million-dollar question that anyone has when we're diagnosed with cancer. It's the same question I ask myself, and that is, wow, what do I do now? And what the program does is it allows patients and their primary personal caregivers to cut through the chaos of their diagnosis, to focus their vital life energy, not on fighting cancer, and that's a key point of differentiation in the program, not on fighting cancer, but on healing from it, so they can create their own empowered answer to cancer. In short, the program aims to inform, inspire, and empower. I believe information plus inspiration equals empowerment. And if there's a weakness we've taken to our approach to cancer education for patients, it's that we give them too much information, but not enough inspiration. And inspiration comes from hearing the stories of others. And that's what I heard over and over and over again in the 10 years in which I worked with patients and with survivors. I heard lots of inspiration. So I weave together that information and inspiration, and that creates empowerment. Therein lies the strength of the program. It's that combination of information and inspiration. I call them survivors, regardless of whether they're in treatment or not, because if you're alive and you've had cancer for 5 minutes, 5 months, 5 years, 50 years. If you're alive, that makes you a survivor.
This is Lynn Thompson, and I have a very special guest with me today, Alan Hobson. He is no stranger to overcoming adversity or bouncing back from setbacks and facing fear. And fear is something we can easily be talking about in these days, being the middle of April 2020. Alan was a member of 3 self-guided and self-organized expeditions to the world's tallest peak, that being Mount Everest. 3 years after standing on top of the world, he fell to the bottom when he was diagnosed with the very aggressive blood cancer, acute leukemia, and he was given less than a year to live at that point. At diagnosis, 90% of the cells in his bone marrow were cancerous, and it was a very long fall, and it was to prove to be an even longer and harder climb back. He endured over 500 hours of infusion chemotherapy, including 120 hours of high-dose chemotherapy to virtually eliminate his immune system at the time. Then he received the modern-day equivalent of a bone marrow transplant. Today, Alan is one of less than a few dozen people in the world ever to regain an elite level of fitness after an adult blood stem cell transplant for the treatment of leukemia. And to give you some perspective on that, it's a tiny fraction of the number of people who have climbed Mount Everest, which he has also done. Alan Hobson has appeared on Oprah and is the author of 7 books. And now he has created the world's first program for those newly diagnosed with cancer. It's called the Climb Back from Cancer Survivorship Program. It's available through the new website, which I've just looked at. It's beautiful. It's called survivecancer.ca. And I am pleased to welcome Mount Everest climber, summiteer, 2-time cancer survivor, and a very long friend of mine, Alan Hobson. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Lynn, and thank you. That was actually a little overwhelming, that description. Who's that dude?
That's you.
It's scary, isn't it, though?
It's a lot. I remember playing football and road hockey and baseball with you in Ottawa growing up when we were kids. And I am so proud to call you friend. And you just have the most tenacity and creativity and perseverance of anyone I know. And I just think the world's a better place for having you in it.
Likewise to you, Lynn. Thank you. I'm touched by that. Thank you.
We have a lot to talk about today because I reached out to you. I know that you've been having incredible success with this program. And looking on your site, I just see some testimonials and people who are really benefiting from this. So we want to hear more about the program, why you developed it, who you see that it's going to benefit the most, and how it works for distributing it. So we want to know all these things. And we also want to know how you have handled fear in your life through climbing and making the descent from Mount Everest, which is part of it. And just in life, some of these things you've experienced, I think what you can share with us from your perspective is going to be really helpful for those listening today.
Thank you. Why did I develop this program, I think was what you asked?
It's a good place to start, yeah.
Okay. Well, I developed it, Lynn, because nothing like it existed when I was diagnosed. When I was diagnosed, I looked around for someone who could help me cope with the anxiety, uncertainty, stress, and change that come with a diagnosis. But most importantly, I went looking for someone who could tell me which steps I need to take and in what order. Something like a coach. I had a background in competitive sports, so I went looking for a coach. I couldn't find one. It was then that I realized that there was a significant gap in the patient experience, and something was needed to bridge that gap. Informationally, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. So after my treatment, I spent 10 years coaching scores of newly diagnosed cancer patients, as well as their survivors and caregivers. And I noticed that regardless of what kind of cancer they had, they were all facing similar challenges because they were all asking me the same kinds of questions. So after a while, I mean, sometimes I'm slow, but after a while I picked up on this. I pulled out a notebook and I started to write down the questions they were asking me. And then I started to flesh out the answers. And that led to the creation of the Climb Back from Cancer Survivorship Program today. But I didn't do it alone. I had a lot of input in producing the program from a wide-ranging team. I had oncologists and oncology nurses. I had psychiatrists and psychologists, social workers, dietitians. I had cancer community leaders, and of course, I had patients, survivors, and caregivers. So in short, this program has been extensively researched, and I can assure you, exhaustively reviewed. And I can also say with 100% confidence that it is as clinically accurate, as medically accurate as I could possibly make it at this time in the history of cancer research and treatment.
Wow, it probably wasn't great at the time, as you described, but the great thing is you are speaking from experience, and you made a lot of connections during your time in hospital and treatment.
Yeah, when you go through the modern-day equivalent of a bone marrow transplant, as you mentioned, Lynn, an adult blood stem cell transplant, you get exposed to virtually every single department in the hospital, from pulmonology, psychology, oncology, even dentistry, because they want to create a baseline set of results before the transplant, and then they test you again on the same battery of tests after the transplant to see how well you've done. And my biggest side effect of treatment, and this is actually the number one side effect of cancer patients and survivors, was chronic fatigue. As you mentioned, I went through a huge amount of chemotherapy. On the day of my stem cell transplant, I was so weak from fatigue, I couldn't stand for more than a minute. In fact, I timed it. It was 53 seconds. I couldn't stand for more than 53 seconds. And as you mentioned, it was a very, very long fall, and it proved to be an even longer and harder climb back. But thanks to mild aerobic cardiovascular activity, so walking, biking, and then when I was free of treatment, also swimming, I was able to gradually rebuild my energy. And I talk about that in the program, about how to rebuild your energy, not only after treatment, most importantly, during treatment as well, to maintain as much energy as possible. Because aside from oxygen, our single most important thing that we put into ourselves, in addition to food, is obviously how we expend our energy. So energy is life.
You did a lot of coaching before you sort of pulled together this inspiration to create a program to help people. So was there something that was surprising you the most during that time?
I think if there was something that surprised me the most during that time, it was the consistency of the questions that were being asked of me.
Right.
And I thought, my gosh, here's a woman who has breast cancer, and here's a gentleman who has multiple myeloma, which is a type of blood cancer that affects the bones and blood plasma in particular. And regardless of the kind of cancer they had, they were all asking the same kinds of questions, like, how did you do it? What did you eat? How did you manage your fear? What about fatigue? How can I overcome my fatigue? And on and on. And as I said, sooner or later, I tweaked to this, mostly later, and I started to flesh out the answers to those questions.
You were an elite athlete. You've summited Everest. You've always been, ever since I've known you, very driven in an athletic way. And you eat really well. You have a very specific diet. I'm sure that you questioned why you had two bouts of cancer, and I'm sure that other people wonder how it came to their life, even though you told me the other day when we talked briefly that 1 in 3 people get cancer. It's not like it's really, you know, a rare thing. Do you spend time with yourself and with other people going through that process of questioning why it happened to them, to you?
Well, there's no question that, like everyone who's diagnosed with cancer, you do ask that. Why? I mean, I used to think that climbing the world's tallest peak would be the biggest challenge I'd face in my life. And that was until I was diagnosed with a very aggressive blood cancer, acute leukemia. And I will never forget the day of my diagnosis. I mean, I will certainly never forget the words, because they hit me with the force of a Mack truck. I mean, instantly my life shattered into shards. First, I was dazed, Lynn. I was numb, completely disoriented. I couldn't speak. I couldn't focus. I couldn't even think. But most of all, I couldn't accept. I couldn't accept the fact that I had cancer. I mean, from my perspective, as you mentioned, I mean, I'd exercised daily. I'd eaten right. I'd lived what I thought was a clean life my whole life. I hadn't smoked or done drugs of any kind. In fact, the strongest thing I'd ever drunk was herbal tea, skim milk, and apple juice. I asked myself, you know, how could I possibly have cancer? Because I was then 42 and in the prime of my life. But as you may know, without treatment, acute leukemia is 100% fatal.
So you had to have treatment. You didn't have a choice. You couldn't just keep eating right and hope that it would go away.
I couldn't keep eating right and hope that it would go away. And I think if there's a weakness I see that some survivors take, it's that they try to take a soft approach to cancer. Well, I'm going to try herbs, or I'm going to improve my diet, or whatever. And unfortunately, when we do that, it gives cancer an opportunity to get ahead of us. And cancer treatment is all about timing. It's about how far advanced your cancer is, where it is, how much it's spread in your body, whether there's a treatment for it, if you can get access to the treatment, and then how effective that treatment is. A lot of those variables are outside your control. But when we're diagnosed, one thing is within our control, and that is how quickly we move and how we manage our minds through that process, through that anxiety, the uncertainty, the stress, the change. All of that has to be managed at the same time.
Can you tell us a bit more about what the content is? What would a person expect?
The program's content, Lynn, is broad and comprehensive. Essentially, it's an A to Z, or A to Z if you live in America, of survivorship, but from the patient's perspective. So diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment options. We've got fear and energy management, depression, meditation, fatigue, immunity. It's comprehensive, clear, and concise. It's essentially a short course on how to maximize your chance of surviving cancer and surviving beyond it, because it takes the avalanche of information that hits us at diagnosis and it reduces it down to just the essential information that we need to know. And that saves the patient and their primary personal caregivers weeks of time and energy scouring the internet. It decreases their anxiety and fear and instills hope and confidence. So it allows them to create a sense of empowerment and hope in a situation that may feel completely out of control. So it's not just one more thing for the patient to do a diagnosis. In fact, it's 1,000 less things. I call it, in fact, a rope of hope, because it's everything we need to know if we're diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, you called it a rope of hope. Is that what you said?
A rope of hope, exactly.
Nice.
So kind of lower the rope to the person who's fallen into the crevasse that is cancer, and give them a tool with which to climb out of that crevasse, or at least maximize their quality of life as they are doing so.
And with the content, Alan, you can listen to it all at once, or you can take it step by step so you can sort of keep current with the stage that you're at, right?
Yeah, you can pick and choose. You can start, I mean, I actually walk the folks through a series of steps. So it's a 7 steps, in fact. They're designed in order on purpose, but you can use them in any particular order. And the objective is to reduce the stress, you know, build confidence, and instill hope. Take the focus off the medical treatment, over which, let's face it, most of us have very little control, and put the focus on those things that are actually within our control. So what Dr. Ted Motor Jr. called the 6 essentials for life. So what we eat, what we drink, what we think, what we breathe, how we rest, and how we're active. In other words, our personal health. Like, I call that healing from the inside out, because the idea is that the medical care providers provide medical care from the outside in, but we are responsible for our own health care from the inside out. So in creating that, what I call healing partnership between our medical care providers and ourselves as patients and caregivers, the whole can become greater than the sum of its parts. So I should say, though, that I would never be so bold as to suggest, even for a minute, that you can take something as complex as a cancer experience and boil it down to 7 simple steps, because, of course, you can't. But it's important for patients to get off on the right foot, and that's the objective here. Get people off on the right foot, give them the tools they need to climb, and head their way up the mountain.
Well, that sounds good. And then I wanted to know, too, if you're finding that there's a particular group of cancer patients who are being drawn to your program that are finding the most benefit from it.
Very interesting question, Lynn. I've seen a wide range of cancer patients come to this site. Breast cancer patients, head and neck, blood cancers like leukemia, lymphoma, colorectal, prostate, lung, virtually every type of cancer. But amongst those types, the biggest single group is women with breast cancer, specifically women aged roughly 35 to 65. About 40% of the program participants are women with breast cancer. The balance is a sprinkling of other forms of cancer. Obviously, it's smaller percentages. The reason I believe that women are drawn to this program is because it speaks not only to information, but also the emotion and the inspiration that goes with the program. The emotion of being faced with this mountain and having to figure out a way up it, and the inspiration required to do it in addition to the information. It's that combination that women really seem to get. Everyone gets it, but I feel, and it looks like, women seem to get it even more than others. Women are deep, they are passionate, they are engaged, and they are engaged with themselves and with others. That is just one of the many powers that women have, and I think in using this program, they'll be able to patch into that power.
What I wondered, too, though, Alan, is why do you feel so driven to follow through on this? I mean, you survived. You could just go off into the sunset and leave it all behind. Like, why are you choosing to stay in that environment and be such an advocate for cancer survivorship?
Well, I want to be an advocate for cancer survivorship because I want people to have something I didn't have.
Right.
This didn't exist when I was diagnosed.
Yeah.
I was at a loss. So like a lot of people who recognize things that are missing in our world, that's what was missing for me. I'm like, okay, so this is missing. What can I do to improve this situation? I've been given the gift of a second chance at life, and with that gift comes a responsibility. I'm sure you've heard the expression, to whom much is given, much is expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taken that on as a responsibility of my survivorship. And that's why I'm driven, and it's been 6 years in this journey, thousands of hours of work in developing a website and developing a guidebook and developing an audio guide to go with the guidebook and 2 other books that I'd previously written that are actually that tie beautifully into the program. And that creates the whole package that I believe people need from diagnosis through treatment, recovery, and beyond it. So it's a continuum, but the core of the program is a 100-page guidebook, which basically gives people everything they need to know if they're diagnosed with cancer.
And the audiobook goes along with the guidebook, right? Like you can follow along?
Yeah, so you can switch instantly from the written word to the spoken word and back again. So the guidebook is essentially a transcription of the audio guide, even though, of course, the audio guide began from the guidebook. Everything begins from the written word, obviously, in that particular case anyway. So, yes, they don't have to take any notes. It's all right there, and they can go through this thing in a single evening. It's not going to overwhelm them. It's concise. It's comprehensive. I've strived with every single word to make sure it's clearly understood. I have to confess that in all the books I've ever written and all the creative things I've ever done, this was by far the hardest thing I've ever done. Imagine, if you will, you want to put cancer into 100 pages of everything the newly diagnosed patient needs to know at diagnosis. Well, it's a bit like trying to put Mount Everest into a bell jar.
Yeah, you've invested a lot, obviously, on a lot of levels into this. And I think you have a creative way for this to reach people, right? Can you describe the model that you've created around this?
Well, it's available online through a website, and I've got sponsors who've sponsored patients to receive the program. So the program is free to those newly diagnosed or their primary personal caregivers. And what they do is they go on the site, survivecancer.ca, and if they want to sponsor someone, then they click on the tab that says gift the program. If they want to receive the program, they click on the tab that says receive the program. And they go through all the links, and then they put in a code, which is linked to a sponsor, and they get the program, the Basecamp form of the program, for free. And then they get the opportunity to thank the sponsor through the website. So the sponsor knows immediately that their funding has gone somewhere to a specific person for a specific purpose.
Wow.
And therein lies the strength of the website. I call it the circle of giving. So sponsor gives, survivor or patient receives, then survivor or patient thanks the sponsor, and the circle's complete.
I think that's pretty unusual.
As far as I know, Lynn, it is. I mean, I didn't spend vast amount of time going through the net seeing if any other model existed like this, because I knew that ours had to be unique, that it had to work effectively. So it looks like a simple site, but it's not in terms of its functionality. At least I don't think it's simple, although I have to confess that I'm about as close to a techno-peasant as you can get. nonetheless, it's designed to be super simple, super easy to use. Go on there, survivecancer.ca, either gift the program or receive the program, and you're off to the races.
Did you want to share who the sponsors are or talk about them at all, give them a shout-out?
The sponsors right now are actually private individuals who are cancer survivors.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, we see the value in the program. I go, yeah, let's get this out. Let's get this out in the world. And my next objective is to find organizations that want to distribute this program to their members, whether they be employees or association members. If it's an association, it could be their clients, their vendors, their suppliers, family and friends, so that the program gets distributed as widely and as quickly as possible. Anybody who wants to be a sponsor can go on the site and click on the tab on survivecancer.ca that says gift the program. They sign up as a sponsor, and then they decide how many patients or caregivers they want to sponsor. They put that number in, they sponsor those individuals, and then when those individuals get the program, the individuals have an opportunity to thank them. It's a powerful platform, and it's having great impact.
If you go through the program, you've benefited from it, as you say, then a survivor can become a sponsor themselves. Well, anybody can, but I mean, it's a way to gift it forward as well as to thank the sponsor who got you there.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's part of this, the circle of giving continues, right? Karmic return, karmic return, karmic return. I help you, you help me, we all help together. So it's not about me, it's about we and the power of we. And therein lies the real essence of it all.
You've got a lot of wealth of information here and all the links that you have described.
Yeah, I think it was Oscar Wilde who once said that he'd have written shorter if he'd had more time. Because it's one thing to write a book, and I've written ones previous to this, as you mentioned. It's quite another to write a short book that's concise on an incredibly complex subject. And I'm blessed to be able to say that the program has met with and received praise from both professional medical providers and patients alike. So all the way across the board, people are getting something out of this program, and they're getting a lot out of the program.
Congratulations on that, Alan. It's been really amazing to watch you go through this process. And you've been speaking from the stage in all kinds of venues for many, many years. And what timing that you were already kind of winding that down when you have to stay home like a lot of us right now?
Yeah, exactly. So in essence, this is my life legacy, Len. It's my gift to the world. I had a lot of satisfaction from being a speaker, but I would like to have even more satisfaction helping patients and their caregivers.
It brings it home down off the stage into people's lives in a whole different way. And I really congratulate you on your perseverance, because you've really created, as you say, a real legacy. Yeah.
Well, thanks. But I mean, as you say, the timing right now couldn't be more appropriate, because here we are in the middle of COVID-19. You know, it's interesting. If you compare cancer with COVID-19, I went on the net this morning, did a bit of research, and I discovered that worldwide there's about a 95% chance of surviving COVID. And as you mentioned, for the case of cancer, there's a 1 in 3 people who will be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime. 1 in 4 will die of cancer. That's the bad news. Good news is that across all cancers today, 2 out of every 3 people diagnosed survive the disease. That's right. Across all cancers today, 2 out of every 3 people diagnosed survive the disease. Nonetheless, that means the survival rate for cancer is 66%. For COVID, it's 95%. The key, though, is that the worldwide cancer pandemic has existed for hundreds, literally hundreds of years. In the past, survival rates have been even worse than they are right now. So there's really no comparison between the seriousness of COVID and that of cancer, except that COVID, of course, is contagious, whereas cancer is not. COVID is also something new and something we don't yet fully understand. And we human beings fear things that we don't understand. But nevertheless, I would hasten to point out that in spite of the severity of COVID, in spite of the severity of cancer, public enemy number one isn't COVID. It isn't even cancer. Public enemy number one is still climate change. That is the biggest single threat to the human race at this moment.
That's kind of been put to the side a little bit, although people are noticing that with people staying home, that the planet is like calming down, becoming more clean. Animals are coming back into their territories. We are getting a glimpse of what is possible, aren't we, right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there have been lots of positive results from COVID. I mean, we've got, obviously mentioned, less CO2 emissions equals, you know, cleaner air. We're driving less. We're staying at home more. There's less noise. As you mentioned, nature and wildlife is essentially retaking the space that humans had colonized. I mean, I was out driving in my back alley. I run a bicycle the other night, pedaling along, not really paying attention. I look up, and there's 2 elk standing right in front of me. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Now, I live in the King Rocky Mountains north of Montana. We live in concert with nature, but that's the very first time I've seen elk in the back alley next to my office. So they are retaking that land, and happily, I might say. We're living locally. We're telecommuting. We're having online meetings. They've exploded. I mean, and less buying means less consumption of precious non-renewable resources. So there's a lot of pluses coming out of this situation. Socially, we've all realized now that we are incredibly interconnected on a global level. And that has underscored the critical importance of family, friends, relatives, even strangers we pass in the street. You know, we pass on them. We have the 2 meters or 6 foot distance between the two of us. We still, you know, wave, smile, and say hello. But the biggest single message and thing that we've all learned here is the critical importance of human health. And that's one thing that absolutely was driven home to me during my cancer experience. If we don't have our health, we don't have anything. We cannot operate a business. We cannot generate income. We cannot contribute to our relationships. So it all comes down to the fundamental foundation of human health. And that, of course, is built on the health of the climate of the planet.
Yeah. You live in Canmore, Alberta.
Yes, I live in Canmore, Alberta, which is about a little over an hour's drive west of Calgary, the home of the Calgary Stampede, the greatest outdoor show on earth, as they say.
On your website that we're talking about, survivecancer.ca, there's some gorgeous videos with you, of course, in them, and also the mountains in the background. That alone is worth visiting the site for and finding out more from you talking about it there.
Yes, although I hasten to point out, Lynn, that the mayor of Canmore has publicly declared that he actually doesn't want visitors from outside the town at this time during COVID, because we simply don't have the infrastructure with 30,000 people here.
Yeah.
Actually, not 30,000 now, but it's about 15,000 now, but it would project to be 30,000.
All the more reason then to admire it from a distance through these little videos.
Yeah, so no question about that. But I will say that I am not sparing any opportunity here to get out above tree line, to climb in the outdoors, because if there's one environment that is pristine, it's the mountains.
And you know that very well.
Yeah, it's a safe place to be. Your COVID's not going to get you there, as far as I know, unless we discover something very remarkable about COVID. It's not going to get you in the rocks and the windswept vistas of the mountains above treeline.
Well, unless it has proclivities that we're just not aware of yet. Maybe it does want to be a hiker and it's tired of being in the city and people are not accepting it as it wants to be accepted.
Yeah, again, it all comes down to how much do we know? And the answer is we don't. And
yeah.
The less we know, the more we have fear.
I was just going to say, it's that uncertainty, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I remember a moment on Everest when I came face to face with my own fears. It was on the south side of Everest in Nepal. As you may know, there's actually two sides to Everest, northern side in Tibet and a southern side in Nepal. And I was going through the Khumbu Icefall, which is a glacier that gets squeezed between Mount Everest on one side and its sister peak, Mount Noopsi, on the other. It tumbles 2,000 feet over a rock ledge and splits into ice blocks the size of houses. Whole thing's in constant motion. And in this icefall, there are deep, deep crevasses, which are cracks in the ice, some of them as deep as 150 feet deep, so 45, 50 meters deep, 15 stories deep. If you fall in there, you'll never, ever come out. And the way we get across these crevasses is we lower ladders across them. We lash together the appropriate number of ladders, and then we lower them into place, kind of like a drawbridge. But I remember the first time going across these ladders, I realized that I had a choice. I could look down into the deep, dark depths of the crevasse, or I could focus on the ladder. So I could let myself be overcome by fear, or I could decide to focus on the small steps I could take today to take us from where I was then to where I wanted to be. And it's exactly the same for all of us right now. Do we focus on fear, or do we focus on the small steps we can take today to manage that fear? So case in point, COVID-19. The small steps are stay 6 feet or 2 meters apart, wash our hands frequently, keep our hands away from our face, and avoid non-essential travel. And those are just some of the basics of what we can do. In a case of cancer, it's to focus on what Dr. Ted Mortar Jr. called, and Dr. Ted Mortar Jr. was a chiropractor, a healer. He discovered something called the six essentials for life, and they are basically what we eat, what we drink, what we think, what we breathe, how we rest, and how we're active. So what we eat, what we drink, what we think, what we breathe, how we rest, and how we're active. And those are the primary focuses of the Climb Back from Cancer Survivorship Program, those elements over which we have control. So when we are frightened, when we are overwhelmed, we have to pull it back into the present and focus on what we can do right now to get us from where we are now to where we want to go. And that choice, unlike so many in life, is 100% within our control.
You're right. It's the things that we can't control that get us running around in circles. But when we look at what we can do, it can really calm it down.
If we all practice the age-old serenity prayer, mm-hmm. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, it can bring us a great deal of personal peace. Because I believe that on the other side of fear is freedom. On the other side of fear is freedom. And the key to unlocking that door is having the courage to take the first step, because once we've taken the first step, we're off balance. We take another and another and another. Now, as it relates to COVID, I say, you know, we can find that freedom together. We can climb back from COVID if we stand apart. Yes, if we stand apart, but stand together.
That sounds like a plan.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to execute on. I mean, there are already economic pressures being brought to bear, but let's get the economy restarted and, you know, let's get back to work. Well, that's all well and good, but tell that to the virus. The virus doesn't care whether you're putting it at work or not. In fact, from the point of view of the virus, woohoo, more the merrier. The closer the contact, the merrier, the better, the more I get to propagate. We don't want that. We want to minimize and not just flatten this curve. We want to crush it so that we can begin to manage the situation so we can take back control of our lives.
You know, there's so many repercussions from this time. Well, one of them being that we're having the time where a lot of people just were rushing and feeling time-starved, as it were. And so it's like this big gift that's being given to us where our mandate is to stay home and to take care of ourselves. I mean, when do you hear that?
Yeah, take care of ourselves and also take care of others. I mean,
yeah.
We really are our brothers and sisters' keepers. And if there's one thing that COVID-19 has taught us, it's attention to the vulnerable population groups, people like seniors, and I'm actually in that group myself, those with underlying health conditions, the homeless, the poor, refugees, many of the people in developing countries or even isolated communities in the north or even in our prisons. These are the vulnerable of our society. And I'm hoping that if there's going to be good that comes from this experience, and we will get through this experience, this adventure, I like to call it, or some days I feel like it's a misadventure, but nonetheless, it may lead to better operating procedures in care homes, better pay and benefits for those who work there. And I think, more importantly, greater respect for frontline essential services and service workers. So doctors, nurses, pharmacists, drugstore employees, grocery store workers, truckers, train engineers, I mean, shipping captains, even bicycle shop owners. I mean, I still ride my bicycle because it's part of maintaining my health. I get exercise daily. And so my bike shop is actually, for me, an essential service, believe it or not. So
yeah,
it's given us a whole new perspective on what's really important. And as you said, time. We're less hurried. We have simpler living. We have more time with family, more time to devote to exercise, listening to music, I mean, meditating, doing yoga, heck, making music, or dare I add, making love, for heaven's sakes. I predict that there is going to be a baby boom 9 months after this is over, or even from right now, because we're doing things we've always wished we had time to do. And at the same time, though, here's the real rub of it, we're questioning and assessing our own personal values and lifestyle choices. I mean, what is really important when it comes right down to it?
Well, yeah, I agree. Ultimately, I think that when each of us reaches the end of our lives and we have that moment of a quick review as we're going out the door going, ah, wow, that was fantastic, or, oh, I wish I'd taken more time for this or that. Like, as a collective species right now, it feels like we're being given the time to sort of die, but with time to make a change while we're still here.
Yeah, it's almost like the planet has been spinning, and from the human point of view, it suddenly stopped, or at least slowed down hugely. And when we slow down, we can actually also speed up because we become more efficient, we become more effective. We're operating in an area and in a way in which we're using our time to maximal effectiveness. And we can only do that if we know what's most important. And that, again, is the lesson underlying COVID. That's part of our climb back from COVID.
Oh, yeah. And really, yeah, looking at what's the most important to us and really considering looking ahead and wondering, okay, how do I want to emerge from this? And what can I do to really make use of this time?
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at it, even just from a medical perspective, as I mentioned, it underscores the overall importance of human health above anything else. Despite urges to get back to spending, we're being forced to slow down and take a look and understand that that's important. but it's also exposed weaknesses in our medical care system.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, there's a shortage of personal protective equipment and other emergency supplies like, you know, masks and gowns and gloves and respirators and so on. In fact, in the United States, I think it's shown a weakness in the private medical care system because that private medical care system is based on competition instead of cooperation. And if there's one thing we need to do right now, medically and in other aspects of our lives, it's to cooperate rather than to compete. I mean, I'm literally a living example of the power of universal health care. The other day, for example, I sat down, I did the math on how much before I was age 18 my parents had paid into the Canadian health care system. And then when I was 18, right to the point of my diagnosis at age 42, how much I paid in, I add those two numbers together, Lynn, the answer was $38,000. So my parents and me, over the course of my lifetime to age 42, had paid $38,000 in healthcare premiums. But the price of the procedure and treatment I received, an adult blood stem cell transplant, 500 hours of chemotherapy, the price of that procedure was at least $500,000.
Oh.
That's the power of socialized medicine. And in America, I find it fascinating that for some reason, which is confusing to me, because the Americans are incredibly bright, is why do they think the word socialism means communism? It doesn't. It means care for one's fellow human being. This isn't socialized medicine. It is universal health care. And that's critically important differentiation that I think COVID has also taught us as we watch the death toll and the havoc being caused south of the border. It's painful for me to watch. I have lots of close friends in America, and my heavens, it's just sad. But as I say, if there's something positive that comes out of it, I hope it's the emphasis and understanding of the power of universal health care, because I'm a living, breathing, talking example of that.
Yeah.
And I see lots of other opportunities. I mean, economically, for example, we got a fantastic opportunity here to move to greener energy. I know of a person down the hall from me in the office who works for a prominent North American environmental think tank. And the job of the think tank is to advise government and industry on environmental issues. And she has reported to me that her workload has increased 200%. Since COVID began on March the 10th or thereabouts, because the government is working on a greener economic stimulus package. In addition to that, of course, new businesses are popping up all over the place. Everything from distilleries shifting to producing alcohol instead of liquor and using that alcohol to produce hand sanitizers. You know, businesses making masks and gloves and gowns and respirators and so on. Even hand cream manufacturers are going to do really well in this. And that will spur new investment and help the financial markets to come back, possibly even stronger than before. I mean, it's no secret to anybody that Amazon and Netflix
yeah.
are doing booming businesses. And so are the telecommunications company in transporting all of this bandwidth as people start to telecommute from home. Even at a personal financial level, and I've certainly learned this, it has underscored the importance of personal savings and making sure that we resist the urge to live beyond our means and try to live as simply, as peacefully, and as productively as possible.
That's really good to hear that there's a stimulus package for green energy, because certainly this is also an opportunity to look at different ways that we can go forward and not just go back to things that obviously needed reassessment on a major scale.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the term, when do things get back to normal?
Yeah.
Because I heard that when I came out of cancer treatment. They said, you're going to have to adjust to the new normal. And I thought to myself, why do I have to adjust to the new normal? Why can't I develop my own new normal? The new normal was told to me would be a long-term debilitating chronic fatigue. And I decided, well, I'm going to try to see if I can overcome that. But if there is an opportunity here, it lies in an opportunity to reevaluate, re-strategize, and reposition ourselves for the future. This is actually blessing in disguise. As painful as it is for me to say that, watching seniors pass away and those in poverty and even anywhere across the age continuum, there is suffering out there. But in every crisis, there is opportunity, and there is absolutely opportunity here.
Well, that's a hopeful note to come to, Alan Hobson. We've covered a lot today, and I'm really, really pleased that you had time available so that we could have a chat and share it with Living on Purpose listeners.
Pleasure for me, Lynn. Always a privilege and an honor. All I can say to people listening to us is to keep climbing.
Indeed. We'll just keep following you, Alan Hobson.
That's not always the best thing to do.
Yeah, right. We might find ourselves on a mountain that we didn't bargain
for. You sign up for a real adventure, you might just get one.
Indeed. Again, Alan, I so appreciate that we had the time to talk about it today because it's obviously something that can be of great benefit for people and especially women. So welcome to Women's Radio.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, well, we're all in this together and wow, each of us has such a role that we can accept and step into.
Let's do it.
All right. Okay, well, Alan Hobson and the website, it's worth checking out, and a lot of abundant offering here is survivecancer.ca with can in the middle of cancer in capital letters because, of course, you can, right?
Absolutely, you can.
You realize that it's the best decision you ever made to put this program together, like the people that you've reached and that you know are benefiting.
It's good news. And if there's one thing we could all use right now, it's good news. Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks, Alan.
Cheerio.
Okay, cheerio.